All right, this is lesson 8 of the Lord's Day study we've been doing. For those visiting, we have so far gone through historical theology at this point, just looking at the history of the doctrine, and then biblical theology, and basically just running through the relevant Bible verses and discussing them a bit. Today, I'm going to start with the Lord's Day and systematic theology. And that is taking everything that we've discussed at this point and all the Bible references that we've discussed to this point, and then trying to now systematize the doctrine into a cohesive whole and dealing with some of the issues and some of the objections that come up to the Lord's Day. So with that, it was really hard for me to think of an outline for it because I'm not exactly sure where we're going to end up. So... not yet, anyway. So my outline right now for systematics is just its perpetuity and its change. So that is its abiding nature and its perpetually binding upon the church or the people of God. And number two, its change from Jewish to Christian, or from the last day to the first day. And I actually thought that in doing that for systematics, the confession, I do a lot of highlights in this outline. It's going to be awesome. So the yellow indicating my first point there, the perpetuity of it, and the second, the green, indicating the change. So I'm using the confession a bit here to act loosely as our outline for how I intend to approach this. And actually, chapter 21, section 8, will act nicely as an outline for our practical theology when we get there. But we're not there yet. So, with that. The systematic theology part A, if I can, we're going to go over the law. So the first argument for the Lord's Day is that it is a perpetual moral commandment contained in the Ten Commandments. With that, here are my general considerations. Sorry if you can't read it. It's a little small up there, I guess. What I hope to do is give some definitions when we go through the confession here, which I'm going to bring back up. We're going to run into terms like moral, positive, and then ideas of natural law and ceremony. And then number two here, the nature, antecedents, and preeminence of the moral law. So why is it different than, by the way, I'm going to assume that most of us agree with a threefold division of the law, that being moral, judicial, ceremonial. I'm not going to try and defend that. That would probably take a whole nother class to do that type of stuff. So for now, though, I do want to look at why the moral law is different and why that makes the Sabbath command different than other ceremonies. And then number three, the perpetuity of the Decalogue. Including the Sabbath, as the sum of moral law, which I've said like 10 times now. So, perpetuity, it's a cool word. So the confession, I'm going to go ahead and read the confession here. It says, as it is the law of nature that in general a due proportion of time be set apart for the worship of God, so in his word by a positive, moral, and perpetual commandment binding all men in all ages, he has particularly appointed one day in seven for a Sabbath to be kept holy unto him, which from the beginning of the world to the resurrection of Christ was the last day of the week, and from the resurrection of Christ was changed into the first day of the week, which in Scripture is called the Lord's Day, and is to be continued to the end of the world as the Christian Sabbath. I put in red here basically what I'm hoping to cover here in the next few slides. But first, I thought this was a really interesting quote. I've quoted it in full here, so it'll be on the slide deck. This is from Philip Ross. This book is called From the Finger of God. It's a defense of the threefold division of the law. It's really good if you would like a good resource on that. I've used him a lot in some of the ideas that I'm going to bring forward here. But this is a quote from him in his introduction in defending the idea of the threefold division of the law. He says, according to a PCA minister, and I've taken out the name so you're not distracted by the name and you just get the idea. According to a PCA minister, you can probably guess who, nearly all PCA presbyters subscribe to the Westminster Confession of Faith, quote, with only the most minor exceptions, the only common one being with regard to the Sabbath. If, however, such an exception amounts to a wholesale rejection of the confession's approach to the Sabbath, its authors might have judged him a master of understatement. Were the Westminster Confession a garment, you would not want to pull this minor thread unless you wanted to be altogether defrocked. And perhaps the reason that some people pull at this thread is because they regard the confession more of a straitjacket than a garment. Unbuckle the Sabbath, and you are well on your way to mastering theological escapology. I like how he writes, by the way. If this seems overstatement to rival his understatement, let me say that biblical law with its Sabbath is no easily dispensable part of the Reformed doctrinal infrastructure. And what applies to the theology of the Reformed churches often applies to wider Protestant theology. Attempts at performing a precision strike on the Sabbath produce an embarrassing amount of unintended damage. Strike out the Sabbath, and you also shatter the entire category of moral law and all that depends on it. That being biblical anthropology, the justice of God, and even the atonement. What is Christ atoning for? So his point actually here is that the Westminster Confession, you can try and perform a precision strike on the fourth commandment, but you're probably going to do a lot of unintended damage because of the way that the Westminster Confession was formulated, the way that they treated the moral law. You do a lot more damage than you may have intended or thought that you were doing. So, it is interesting, I think, in modern-day Christianity that most modern-day Christians at least give some lip service to the Ten Commandments. They want it in courthouses, they want it in their schools, and their churches. But so they know that it has some kind of importance to it. But when you get to the Fourth Commandment, they suddenly become unsure of the binding nature of the Ten Commandments. Or they do try to perform that precision strike on the Fourth to say, well, that one no longer applies, which we'll see doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. So, all right. So the first question of the larger catechism here that I wanted to look at was, question 92 asks, what did God at first reveal unto man as the rule of his obedience? Answer, the rule of obedience revealed to Adam in the estate of innocence and to all mankind in him, besides a special command not to eat of the fruit of the tree, of knowledge of good and evil, was the moral law. So that brings us to a consideration of natural law, which we've talked about. We talked about a little bit with Aquinas back in historical theology. I tried to make as succinct an answer as I could, an attempt to define what natural law is. There's a lot of different answers. So natural law is that law which is rooted in God's nature necessarily, or by his free will in the order of creation, that is ingrained upon the consciences of men, but suppressed in unrighteousness, and perpetually binding as the moral code that rules over and directs their relationship to God and their fellow man. So that's taken, the reference there to Romans 2 is usually the first proof text of this idea of natural law. So I'll go ahead and read that. Yeah, if I can find my phone. So Romans 2, starting in verse 12. It says, for as many as have sinned without law will also perish without law. And as many as have sinned in the law will be judged by the law. For not the hearers of the law are just in the sight of God, but the doers of the law will be justified. For when Gentiles, who do not have the law, by nature do the things in the law, these, although not having the law, are a law to themselves, who show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and between themselves their thoughts accusing or else excusing them. So that idea there, why I said that it's ingrained upon the consciences of men at their creation. So we're not talking about natural law like the laws of thermodynamics or something here. These are the law, what we know of the moral law as the Ten Commandments now, being ingrained upon our consciences. And the reason I've cited commands 1 through 3 and 9 on deriving from God's nature necessarily. So if you think about it, it's a necessary moral command that there be one, there is only one God, and you only worship one God. It could not be otherwise. There is no, it just necessarily flows from the nature of God. However, there is a second category here worth mentioning, and that's by his free will and the order of creation. And so that might apply to something like the Sabbath, which doesn't necessarily flow from his nature, but does flow from his the order of creation and what he has made. That doesn't make it any less morally binding. It is the moral laws that he has given to bind the consciences of men and in their relation to how to honor him and how to love their neighbor. All right, so I thought it might just be good to think about how the moral law existed prior to its giving on Sinai. So this is Genesis 4, 6 through 7, and I'll just read it as it lies here. So the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry, and why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door. And its desire is for you, and you should rule over it." Another one, pretty quickly after that, Genesis 6, 5 and the flood narrative. "Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually." All right, so the reason I've highlighted, if it's not obvious, is this idea of sin, wickedness, evil. What are these categories apart from a standard or apart from a law? It's not revealed to us anyway in the Bible that what laws specifically were given to the patriarchs or to even Adam and Eve. But it does seem that they had an understanding ingrained upon them that they knew what sin was and they knew what good works were. So with that, I've just highlighted a few bullet points here. So the first is the one I just said. Sin, wickedness, law breaking, etc. They all have reference to a law broken. Sin does not exist where there is no law. And then the Decalogue is assumed throughout the book of Genesis. The giving of the Ten Commandments did not somehow shock or present something new to the people of God. So I've actually listed out, you'll probably just have to go through, so you can actually, if you look through the narratives of Genesis mainly before you get to the giving of the Ten Commandments, you can see every commandment prior to the giving of the Ten. And the understanding that the opposite or the doing of that commandment is sin or not sin. So I've actually listed out some references here. The first commandment, Genesis 3, them desiring to be their own gods, to be just like them. The second commandment, this is the stealing of Laban's idols by Jacob and Rachel. And Rachel then sitting on the idols and saying that she was menstruating. So just the idea of the folly of being able to sit on your gods and... So that's the example here. The third, the name of the Lord is held in high regard throughout Genesis. Swearing by the Lord was, thought to be the most important name to swear by. Even God himself swears by his own name as the highest name he can swear by. The fourth commandment, which we've already looked at, but Genesis 2 in the creation narrative, and then Exodus 16 prior to Sinai. The fifth commandment, Ham invoking a curse by dishonoring his father Noah. The sixth commandment, the murder of Abel. The seventh commandment, Abimelech. So this is an interesting one. The seventh one, adultery. Abimelech is told that Sarah is Abraham's wife by God. Abimelech does not question the morality of adultery, but only that he was lied to and was not aware. So he agrees with God. This would be a bad thing if I were to commit adultery here. But he did not know that that was Abraham's wife. The eighth commandment, Adam and Eve steal the fruit. And then the other reference here in Genesis 30 is to Jacob defrauding Laban. And then the ninth commandment, Abraham lies about Sarah twice. And Jacob, when his mother is telling him to lie to his father to get the blessing, recognizes that if his father realizes it's him, he'll invoke a curse rather than a blessing. So he knows that the lying is wrong. And then the tenth, Genesis 3, Adam and Eve. Genesis 4, Cain is jealous of Abel's offering. And then Joseph's brothers with their father. So we see the Ten Commandments really just running throughout, even before we even get to Sinai. We know, and the reason I'm bringing this up is to, in case it's not clear, is to show that the moral law has a different nature than the other ones, the ceremonial and the judicial. I'm going to see that more clearly in a moment, but I did want to bring up one more, and that is, this is Genesis 26, 4 through 5. I actually mentioned it a couple weeks ago and told you to just trust me that it's in there, but I'm going to read it for you now because I found it. This is prior to Sinai, in Genesis 26, 4 through 5, and God saying that he will bless Abraham and his descendants. And he says, "And I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of the heaven, and I will give to your descendants all these lands, and in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." This is the first time we actually see the use of that word, which is actually, I only give one reference here in Nehemiah because I think it's the most relevant one, but you see it running throughout the Pentateuch, this idea of his law and his statutes. There's no indication that this is somehow different laws, different, you know, that he did have a law prior to the giving of the law. In Nehemiah 9:13, he uses the same language in describing what was given to them on Mount Sinai. He says, speaking to God, "You came down also on Mount Sinai and spoke with them from heaven and gave them just ordinances and true laws, good statutes and commandments." So the same idiom or verbiage used here. So this is Philip Ross again. If I quote him, yeah, all right. So his point after this, a lot of this is taken from his book, but his point after all of this is to say, we need not read far in Genesis to realize that the Pentateuch portrays a world subject to universal moral government. This is prominent in the flood narrative, which states that the Lord saw how great man's wickedness had become and presupposes that existing moral laws define such wickedness. The words recorded in Genesis 26 above are a significant word usage. This is the first time the Pentateuch uses these words, which are of considerable significance later. Abraham did not need the Decalogue to know what God expected of him, confirming that, according to the Pentateuch, knowledge of its content predated its delivery. Okay. So, are there any questions to that point before I go forward, or any comments there? Okay. Alright, so this is the next question in the Westminster Larger Catechism. It asks the question, what is the moral law? It says, the moral law is the declaration of the will of God to mankind, directing and binding everyone to personal, perfect, and perpetual conformity and obedience thereunto, in the frame and disposition of the whole man, soul and body, and in performance of all those duties of holiness and righteousness which he owes to God and man, promising life upon the fulfilling and threatening death upon the breach of it. So if you've heard the term the covenant of works, you can kind of see it running throughout here. So we do, at least in the Westminster tradition, say that a covenant of works was given to Adam in the garden. Not that there was no grace involved, just that there was a law, and we would say the moral law, given to him, and that he was expected to have conformity and obedience to it. Even if delivered in maybe less words than it is at Sinai, this was the covenant of works. But upon the breach of it, he now incurred the wrath of that law, or the wrath brought about because of the breach of that law. But that doesn't in any sense say that that law therefore somehow is abrogated or done away with. Every human being is now beholden to that law. It doesn't change. Everyone being the progeny of Adam inherits now that curse for violation of that law. So that's, you can see some of that running through here. But I did want to say, so here we see the moral law is always spoken of in universal terms. No nation is freed from it in the Old Testament. No individual. The world is flooded for sin and wickedness. Sodom and Gomorrah are destroyed for breaches of it. Judgments are brought on nations. And I think the most important point, Christ has come to fulfill it in order to redeem mankind from all nations, languages, etc. So if the law does not have a universal and perpetual applicability, neither does the remedy. So long as men remain without Christ, they are bound to the breach of the covenant of works. So, and then, but the objection still remains, well, the Christian is no longer obligated to follow the law. So that's usually the argument. You actually hear this a lot now. It's become really popular with a certain evangelical preacher recently on unhitching ourselves from the Old Testament and Christians, making sure Christians understand we are no longer to keep the Ten Commandments or to be bound by it in some sense, to follow it. So I want to start first by presenting maybe a few issues with that idea. And the first is that there is no meaningful rule of Christian life without it. So if you say Jesus as the rule, then you're only pointing to the embodiment and fulfiller of the law. And it also gives the Old Testament little to no relevance, which I suppose is the intent of this particular preacher. The second is, it misunderstands the nature of natural law as being rooted in God's nature and the created order. Christ redeems the possibility of fulfilling what man was created to be, namely a keeper of God's law. And then the third, they're usually only meaning one law. I just want to point that out. And rarely is the objection levied as speaking of the other nine. I found this a lot in speaking to people who will say this type of thing. And obviously they have no issue if you were to say, you shouldn't murder. Like, yeah. You should worship the one true God. Yeah. And you can go through all nine of them. You should keep the Sabbath. No. So it is usually in reference to only one law that is no longer of abiding validity. And then I think it contradicts Jesus and the apostles' understanding of the law, which we'll get to in a moment. But I did want to quote here Samuel. This is Samuel Bolton. He was a Westminster divine. And he's actually speaking against the antinomians. And he says, whatever they, the antinomians, say of the law, yet we know that for the substance of it, it is the image of God, a beam of his holiness. The things therein commanded and forbidden are things morally, and therefore eternally good and evil. Nothing can alter the nature of them. Things not by nature, either good or evil, are alterable by him that commanded them. But those things which are morally good or evil, God can no more alter than make evil good or good evil. That which was morally good formerly is morally good now, and is to be pursued and practiced. That which was formerly morally evil is morally evil now, and is to be shunned and avoided. We have a gospel rule which turns us to obedience to the law. We find it in Philippians 4:8. Whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue and if there be any praise, think on these things. And I hope the law is of this number. The apostle tells us that the law is holy and just and good. Certainly in it there is nothing commanded but what is good. So the abiding validity, and that last point there, I said it contradicts Jesus and the apostles' understanding of the law. And I think one thing that you really have to deal seriously with if you're going to reject the Ten Commandments is, actually I don't know if this is the ESV anymore. But I'm going to go ahead and read it from here. Matthew 5:17-19. I take that back. I'm going to read it from here. I want to start at verse 16. And this, I'll be reading the New King James, so if it contradicts this, I'm sorry. Alright, so, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. Do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For assuredly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled. Whoever therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. Okay, so the first thing to note here is that that passage, I've actually heard more of a New Covenant theologian. They really like to emphasize this idea, though. They'll say, I've not come to abolish it, but to fulfill. And like, by, and what they kind of mean by saying that, fulfill, is basically the same as to abolish it. In a lot of ways, it is actually making Jesus say the opposite of what he just said, that I didn't. So whatever the meaning of fulfill here is, it can't mean I come to abolish the Ten Commandments. I think everyone in here will probably agree with that. Alright, so, the likely answer to what he means by to fulfill is probably the most simple one. And there is a lot of debate over it, but I really think it's probably the most simple, which is that he has come to obey it perfectly, thereby securing the righteousness by which we are made righteous. So, that would be my take. There is also maybe some, deliberation over what law he's speaking of. Abrakel, in his Christian's Reasonable Service, takes it as meaning the Ten Commandments, or the moral law. And these are the reasons that he states. And the reason I read verse 16, where he says, so that they will see your good works, Abrakel says, it is that law which is the rule for good works, and thus for a holy life. Verse 16. Number two, it is that law which Christ did not come to disannul, since he did come to disannul the ceremonial law. Number three, it is that law which Christ has fulfilled, so that by his obedience we are made righteous. Number four, it is that law which will endure as long as the earth will remain. Number five, it is that law which one was not permitted to break upon the coming of Christ, but which one was obliged to do and teach. And number six, it is that law in which murder, the false and unnecessary swearing of oaths, revenge, and adultery are forbidden, and in which generosity and sincere love, even toward enemies, are commanded. This being evident from what follows in this chapter. Therefore, since the fourth is a full-fledged commandment of that law, also this commandment will remain and not pass away. Consequently, this commandment is not ceremonial, but an eternal rule of life, as is true for the other commandments. And then this is, this is Ross. This does speak a little bit against sort of a New Covenant theology stance on this, and he says, any argument that Jesus redefined the law inevitably leads to the conclusion that he also redefined sin. If Matthew's gospel introduces new law in the Sermon on the Mount and then speaks of forgiveness in relation to transgression of the old law, its notion of atonement is incoherent and sin becomes a moving target. It's more likely that Matthew views the sin for which Jesus' blood acquires forgiveness as always traceable to the transgression of constant, self-understood norms that are defined by the Decalogue. All right, and then the other one, the apostles, I've really given, well, I guess I gave, yeah, two apostles. The first being James. What I like about James here is he helps us maybe to understand a little bit that the law, it's easy to think about the Ten Commandments and to think that they can somehow be parsed out as though they're not a coherent whole. What I think he does here in James is he brings together the idea, you'll often hear people, the Ten Commandments are summarized in the two great commandments, to love God and to love your neighbor. And I think James does that a little here. So, James 2, 10 through 13. Back up a little here, yeah. Verse 8. If you really fulfill the royal law according to the scripture, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. You do well. But if you show partiality, you commit sin and are convicted by the law as transgressors. For whoever shall keep the whole law and yet stumble in one point, he is guilty of all. For he who said, do not commit adultery, also said, do not murder. Now if you do not commit adultery, but you do murder, you become a transgressor of the law. So speak and so do as those who will be judged by the law of liberty. For judgment is without mercy to the one who has shown no mercy. mercy triumphs over judgment. And I think verse 10, actually verse 11, "For he who said, 'Do not commit adultery,' also said, 'Do not murder.'" The idea is, it's the same God that you're transgressing against. You could, you know, try and parse out the Ten Commandments. Well, I did this one, but I haven't done this one. That's not the point. The point is that the Ten Commandments are really, they are, in some sense, summed up in those two great commandments, to love God, to love your neighbor. But even those two, I think you could sum up in one, which is obey God. It's just obey me. And so thinking of the Ten Commandments and the moral law and the natural law, the idea here isn't maybe necessarily like how it was delivered at this time period and this 10 precepts and now two. And the idea is always the same. There is one moral law governing how we are to love God and love our neighbor. So, and then the last one here, just because I think it's good to bring this up, because I think people really do talk about the law in a way that does it injustice and really brings it down to almost as though the law itself is sin. So Romans 7:12, Paul says, "And the commandment, which was to bring life," so you remember that idea, this was to bring life. It was original. The original purpose was that Adam would keep it and it would bring life. "But I found to bring death, for sin taking occasion by the commandment deceived me, and it killed me. Therefore, the law is holy, and the commandment holy and just and good." Okay. All right, so the next, is there any questions at that point? Yeah.
I don't have a question, but I have a statement. Jesus did redefine sin, not as in relation to the Old Testament, because this was an Old Testament concept, but he redefined the sin that they understood, especially the Pharisees. It wasn't something, it was outward, and Jesus went right into, if you're angry, if you lust. And so he was taking that Old Testament concept and then saying, I came to abolish the law, I came to fulfill the law, not to abolish it.
To bring up.
That it goes into the heart and it penetrates everything, rather than the superficial view of, as the rich young ruler, these all I've done. You know, I've checked off all those squares. But he coveted, and then the house of cards falls. So.
Mm-hmm. So maybe be more, like myself, could be more clear there. Redefining maybe the common understanding at that point, or the cultural understanding, at least among the Pharisees, of what sin was. Yeah. Huh? Oh, no, you're fine. No, I was just making a clarification that when we say not changing the definition of sin, I mean in the eyes of God, obviously. So yeah. But yeah, that is a good point. He does come to correct and also to reinforce what, is missed often, which is that love is the fulfillment of the law. And that there is a spiritual component to it that had been kind of obliterated by the Pharisees. Yeah. Dave?
There's a certain temptation to be reductionistic about the law. As you pointed out, that Jesus summarizes the law by saying there's two great precepts, love God, love your neighbor. There are a number of any such ways to summarize God's law, including the Ten Commandments, which are a summary of God's law. They're hardly exhaustive of interaction and nuance of life, but they were the 10 words given to help people understand at a higher level what was to be included underneath it.
Exactly. Yeah, and really, if you read the Westminster Confession, there's actually about like 500 commandments, right? But no, that's the idea, is that it's not, you know, 1 is 2 is 10, 10 is 2 is 1 is, I mean, they're... if I walk up and say, obey God, well, how do you do that? By loving God and loving your neighbor. Well, how do I do that? By this. Well, you know, how do I do that? So, that's the idea here, is not necessarily that we need to be parsing it out, but that it is a cohesive moral code, or, yeah, moral law. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm also struck by the need every once in a while to just pause and see. Amazing to me how much we tend to do. We do things that are self-destructive. So we're doing a great job here considering how these things are binding and everything that you're doing, but I'm sitting here thinking, what is we're actually contending over? It's something that is such a blessing to us. We're trying to contend over it. So it's, I'm just struck by the perversion that we are guilty of as people. So for example, if you were starving, your eyes were sunken, you have no energy, you haven't eaten or had any water in days. Like the armies of under King Saul and Jonathan, right before he finds the honeycomb, right? You're spent. And you're arguing with me. I say, well, wouldn't you like some food? No, I'm against food. I'm against water. I don't need that kind of stuff. You're arguing against something that is such a blessing and it's so good to you.
Which was to bring life.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's what, so I'm like, why are you arguing against this thing? And I said, well, don't you want some food? Here's the honeycomb.
Yeah.
Stop that. Get out of my face. And so here we are contending against something that's such a blessing to us. And so that point was made earlier, probably made later too, but I'm just saying that every once in a while I have to stop and think, wow, it's just amazing that we're even having to contend about it.
Right. Well, and yeah, and so
it points us back to our failure.
Sure.
What God has given for our good.
Well, that's perfect application to the Sabbath directly when we get more into that particularly as a blessing. Is stop thinking of it as such a, we don't think of any of the other commandments in that way. It's such a burden and it restricts our Christian liberty. It's a blessing. It's meant for our good. It was made for us to. And I think you bring up a good point. You know, it was meant to bring life, but without Christ, it brings death. But with Christ, does it then bring back kind of its original life-giving, you know, in some sense. Obviously it's in Christ that, but he now enables us to be what we were created to be, and that is God honorers by keeping the law that he's given. So, yeah, no, I think, yeah, that's a good point. Any other? Yeah, Henry.
A couple things, you know, talk about the law being summed up in, you know, loving God, loving theirs, it's like, well, you know, there's a tendency, you know, you're worrying about the tendency about a guy to stop learn once he's married the girl, stop learning about her, and that's generally not doesn't go so well for the marriage. It's like, why do people think it would be any different with, you know, Christ or bride, not to be reading his word and not to be learning
about that's true.
But the other thing is, you know, one of the things that supports the separation of moral and ceremonial law, making the Sabbath be part of the moral law, is, you know, how many times in the prophets of the Old Testament does God pretty much dismiss the sacrifices or the fasting and say, you haven't been keeping my Sabbath. And drilling down on that one.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, our relationship with God, and this is what God said, these are the things that please me. It does develop our relationship with him. Okay, so we're probably only going to be able to get this last part here. The Westminster Confession, which I should have, I did actually. Here it is, sorry. So it makes this statement here, as it is the law of nature, which we've now looked at, that in general, a due proportion of time be set apart for the worship of God, so in his word, by a positive, moral, and perpetual commandment. So what is a positive commandment? And what is a moral positive commandment? So this is Durham in his book on the Ten Commandments. He makes, I think, a good distinction here. He says, when we speak of things moral, we are to distinguish between things naturally moral, that is, as love to God and our neighbor, which have an innate rectitude and holiness in them, which cannot be separated from them, and things positively moral, that have their obligation by a special positive superadded sanction, so that their rectitude flows not from the nature of the things themselves, as in the former, as for instance in the fourth commandment, it is naturally moral that God should be worshipped. Nature teaches it. But that he is to be worshipped on such a day particularly, that comes to pass by virtue of his positive command. The first cannot be altered, the second by the Lord may. But till he alter it, the authority lies still on all. And it is equally sin to sin against any of them. though without the positive sanction, there is no obligation naturally requiring obedience in some of them. So, if that was kind of a mouthful, it is probably easiest just to look at either the Westminster's formulation of it and thinking of the fourth commandment. So here, when it says, as it is the law of nature that in general, a due proportion of time be set apart for the worship of God, that is naturally moral. So you could come to that understanding, if hypothetically you weren't suppressing the truth of God and unrighteousness, you would come to the understanding that there is a God and he ought to be worshipped. So that's naturally moral. All men know that God exists, and they know that he ought to be worshipped. So in his word, by a positive, moral, and perpetual command, and here's the positive aspect, he has particularly appointed one day in seven, the last day of the week, which was changed into the first day. That'd be the positive, moral aspect. You could not, I mean, maybe some people have made the argument, I'm sure, but you could not really derive probably naturally that it ought to be this day for this length of time. So that's the positive. That's what it means when it says a positive moral commandment. All right. Just look ahead real quick. Okay. Next time, I think we're pretty much at the end here. So next time I do want to look at what makes the moral law different than the ceremonial and the judicial. And I think maybe something to think about here is that the judicial and the ceremonial always have reference to the moral law. They don't make sense apart from the moral law. And the moral law is within itself justified. There is no, it's justified in the nature of God and in his created order. The ceremonial and the judicial are not. They always have reference to the moral law. So the ceremonial, for instance, has reference to it would only be necessary in a fallen world where, you know what, I'm going to save that for next time, but it's hard not to get ahead of yourself a little bit, but so the moral law, hypothetically speaking, could exist in an unfallen world and a fallen world. It is what pleases God. It is the law. It is his moral commands. The ceremonial and the judicial don't make sense in an unfallen world. They only make sense in a fallen world where the moral law has been breached and violated. So we'll get to that next time. That'll make a lot more sense. But if you have any questions about that, we can talk later or something. And that is it for today. Were there any other comments or questions? Anything at all? No. And in case I glossed over that really fast, the positive aspect, when we talk about the change of day, which I know has been brought up a lot, that does not affect the morality of the law itself. The morality of the law remains the same. 6 days, rest one. It's just the Lord of the Sabbath has that prerogative to positively change the command to another day. So. Okay, so if there's no questions or comments, I'll leave it alone for now. I'll go ahead and pray and prepare for worship. Father God, we are so thankful for you revealing yourself to us in your word, and revealing your moral law to us. And pray, God, that you would enable us by your Spirit and by the work of Jesus Christ conform to that and to please you in what we do, and even in our worship here. Pray, God, that we would worship you in spirit and in truth. Pray, God, for Pastor Allen, that you would give him wisdom, and pray, God, that you would give us ready minds and ears to hear and to obey. And thank you for Jesus, for all that he has accomplished, and we pray in his name. Amen.